You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of October 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from the 12th edition of the Frieze Art Fair in London's Regent's Park. I'm Robert Bound. On today's show, we'll be dipping our toe into the fast-flowing waters of contemporary art, firstly with Georgina Adam, FT and art newspaper art market commentator. We'll even look at art and meet actual living, breathing artists. Contemporary, see? We'll eat radioactive soup. We'll speak to Eric Fischel. And what's Ryan Gander been up to?
They look like big mind poos. Do you know what I mean? They look like they're kind of messy and dirty.
That is all coming up here in the next hour on a special edition of Midori House, beaming to you all the way from London's Regent's Park this fine autumn evening. Stay tuned. So we have a lot of art credit in the bank, but first it is news time at the top of the hour with Jonathan Wheatley.
The World Health Organization says the number of Ebola cases in a vast outbreak in West Africa will go over 9,000 this week, and the epidemic is still expanding geographically in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia. The death toll so far in the outbreak has reached 4,447. The Canadian government has announced that the human testing of an experimental Ebola vaccine developed by their health agency has already begun. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who has visited Gaza for the first time since the war, has called the situation beyond description and urged a speedy reconstruction effort. He also announced that Israel was permitting a first truckload of construction materials to enter the enclave, which has been blocked by Israel and Egypt since before the conflict.
I'm here with a very heavy heart. The destruction which I have seen while coming to here is beyond the description. This is a much more serious destruction than what I saw in 2009, immediately after the violence at the time.
An estimated 180,000 people have been forced to flee the Iraqi city of Heat after it was captured by ISIS and affiliated forces, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has said at a news briefing on Tuesday. The town, located in Iraq's Anbar province, was home to approximately 100,000 refugees who had previously fled conflict in other parts of the province, including Ramadi and Fallujah. Catalonia has dropped plans to hold a referendum on independence from Spain next month, but will instead hold a consultation of citizens, the region's president said on Tuesday. Catalan regional president Artur Mas said a consultation of citizens will take place on the day the referendum was due, on the 9th of November.
This is a consultation, but we have to change the way to do that. But the aim is exactly the same as it was before, to know the opinion of the Catalan people about what? About the political future of Catalonia, according the question, the two-part question that was agreed some months ago. So it is also a consultation, but held through other ways.
The South African athlete Oscar Pistorius will be broken as a person if he's jailed for killing his girlfriend because of his disability and psychological problems, a defence witness at his sentencing hearing said on Tuesday. The 27-year-old Paralympic and Olympic athlete, whose lower legs were amputated as a baby, was convicted of culpable homicide last month for shooting dead his girlfriend, law graduate and model Reva Steenkamp, on Valentine's Day 2013. And finally, Denmark invariably comes top of surveys naming the world's happiest nation. Economists from the University of Warwick have now spotted an interesting trend among the data. After examining various existing studies, co-author Dr. Eugenia Proto found that people with a genetic makeup closest to the Danes are indeed more cheerful.
The farther you are genetically from Denmark, the lower is the life satisfaction or subjective well-being of the country. Okay, the farther is you are from Denmark, the sadder you are.
Amazing statistics, and that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's just shy of 18.05 here. You're tuned in to a very special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from Regent's Park in London. It's the Frieze Art Fair.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And it's 18.05, you're tuned into Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair in London. On today's show, we'll do all sorts of things. We'll take the temperature of what might just be London's premier cultural occasion of the year with a litany, a treasure trove, an embarrassment of riches of guests to take you, dear listeners, by the hand and lead you through the grey and ochre corridors of a spanky new tent here in London in Regent's Park. And I'll begin by welcoming our first guest. Georgina Adam is the art market editor at large of the art newspaper and of the Financial Times. Georgina, welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
And we feel highly honoured to have whisked you away from the hallowed halls of Frieze here. It's obviously one of your busiest weeks of the year, especially as it's based in London as well. Of late, the last three or four years, it's been a tale of two art fairs, both of them under the same banner, Frieze Contemporary and Frieze Masters. I know you've been to both today. We're going to focus on contemporary mostly, but who's winning that sort of internecine battle, do you think?
Well, I don't think they would say it was a battle, because after all, it's the same people who run both. Personally, for me, I have to say, I think it's a bit of a slam dunk for Masters this year. But it has to be said that Frieze, what we now call Frieze London, the original Frieze Fair, is vastly improved fair this year compared to previous editions. They've got a great new tent. It seems that they've learned from the lessons of New York, where they also run a fair. The tent is much lighter. It's more spacious. They've actually put some carpet down, which is really nice, and you don't get splinters in your feet anymore.
Trust you to walk around barefooted.
So it's got a good airy feel.
There was a thing, wasn't there, last year and the year before, I think they've tried to sort of zizz up the tent. What was the existing tent structure by making what they call wider corridors or wider aisles and all the rest of it, which was kind of a little bit nice, but this genuinely feels like a departure. And I suppose it's all about that thing where you're looking for, you know, were you looking for the horizon when you're in one of these large events and you're hoping for an artwork to catch your eye on the way to the horizon. But it feels like a very different prospect. I wonder if you can tell us with your market hat on whether this redesign is making people reach for their wallets.
Ah, well, that's a different matter. Is it because you can see more clearly across the fair because there are slightly less standy booths, sort of boxy booths? Does that mean that you'll actually buy something? It does mean, of course, that you can see across to something you mightn't have spotted before you bought the first thing. So maybe, but I actually doubt it. I don't think so. But I think the fact that it is a more agreeable user experience should encourage people perhaps to come back. And that, of course, would encourage them perhaps to have another look at something they'd seen and then perhaps buy it the second time round.
And it feels like quite a happy place here this afternoon. I got here just at lunchtime and wandered around, and it looks like a lot of people have made a bit of an effort with their booths, more so than maybe usual. And people are kind of thinking outside of that booth experience. There seems to be a bit more of exuberance and ebullience. There's certainly some big primary coloured booths from big galleries like Gagosian and Pace here today. But do you dig that? Do you pick up a little bit of a joyous spring in the step of buyers and just sort of people watchers alike?
Well, it's a curious thing because we're living in dreadful times. We have the menace of Ebola stalking the world with so many people dying. There's fantastic political instability in the Middle East and elsewhere as well. We've seen, after all, in Hong Kong, we've also seen, you know, a huge amount of sort of Occupy-type rebellion against what's going there, the regime and the voting for the new leader of Hong Kong. So the world is a terrible place, and here we're in a bit of a bubble inside Frieze. And it's curious that very few artists have actually addressed that. There's very few politically motivated artworks. What I have noticed, and which does interest me, is that there's quite an emphasis on what you might call domesticity. A lot of the stands have been curated and are quite crammed with things, and there's a sort of feeling of cocooning, being in a house. Some people have even built sort of houses, and a lot of people have built like drawing rooms. So it's quite curious, is this a refusal of the outside world? I don't know. I can't entirely explain it. But it certainly makes it rather an agreeable place to be at the moment.
Well, sister, it's an interesting point you make there. There are two galleries. I think Helene Ahmad is a Frieze Masters, and he's made that, I think, room called The Collectors, is it? Which is very much like a sort of front room thing or a collector's study. Hauser & Wirth here have made a really interesting sort of luxurious, I don't know, study of a collector as well, maybe. I wondered whether this was just like the super collectors and the people we want. We want to peer into their antechambers. We want to see where they hang these sort of very expensive works of art they bought. Maybe it's a little bit of a joke on the collectors themselves. Maybe there's an oligarch and a sheikh walking around going, that looks nothing like my front room. But there's maybe an element of that to it.
Well, I certainly wouldn't like Helene Ahmad's stand to look like my front room, and it's no criticism of his stand, but it's a frightful mess, really. But it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, you want to go on and say to him, good heavens, what are you doing in Frieze Masters with such a mess tidied up? But of course, that's missing the whole point. And it's extremely well done. As far as I'm concerned, it is by far the best stand to be seen here. Or Hauser & Wirth is very good as well, but he really has pushed the boat out on this one. He told me it took him only 6 months to put together. I'm amazed. But, you know, perhaps he has an army of people finding old copies of art magazines, but it's super successful.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's got that kind of... There is definitely about these events, there's a nosy quality to it. We want to know what people paid for something. We want to know who's talking to who. There is that element to it. And it kind of, I guess, it sort of maybe collates all those suspicions and interests we have into one little space. But to do it in a commercial space, to do it in a booth, I think is a kind of nice idea. I've also noticed a lot of artists kind of trying to resist the idea of being in what is essentially a little white box. Ryan Gander's done paintings that don't fit on the canvas and all these sorts of different things. We'll hear from him later on in the show, actually. I feel there is a bit of, without wanting to use the cliche, maybe we can turn the cliche on its head, people trying to think outside the box. What about when you walk in, Georgina, to the Contemporary Fair, you see Gagosian's stand. There's often a lot of blue chip things, Warhols, Koonses and things. It's a different story today. I kind of like that booth for all its primary coloured craziness.
Yes, and the children are allowed to play on it. That's what's so extraordinary. I mean, normally it's, you know, look but don't touch and keep those children away and no sticky fingers. And on the contrary, he's gone the other way. And I think also the fact that they've got these live performances, which are definitely not easy to sell.
Yeah.
I think this is also, it's part of this event-driven aspect of art fairs, which has become important. And also, I think, in a way, it's an interesting thing. I think it's, to an extent, antithesis of the online aspect. You see, online, you don't get any of that. You don't get that experience of people performing live. You don't get that experience of allowing your children to climb over an octopus as I wouldn't want my kids to climb over an octopus.
I think we'll have to invite our listeners to Google that.
It is a rubber octopus. I do reassure you, there are no live octopuses in Frieze at the moment. So I think that is part of what the fair is trying to do, is they're trying to offer an experience that is different and better than the experience you get online.
And I guess that's the thing. We've got there's the bricks and mortar world of the galleries themselves. There's very separate world of the auction houses, kind of duking it out for supremacy. But then I guess there is this thing of the fair being the sort of collation of all of those things, or all of the galleries being able to sort of join forces together. Obviously, there's competition between booths, and not just in terms of sales, but in terms of a sort of curated thing. I mean, just in terms of some of the major players here, how important do you think Frieze is for them compared to a Basel or compared to one of the new kind of branch out art fairs, maybe in Asia or South America?
Well, there is obviously a pecking order, you know, and Art Basel is at the top. But I have to say, I think with this edition of Frieze has really upped its game, and it's done incredibly well. Of course, it's terribly important for the major galleries. And I think it's interesting the way a lot of them have curated their booths. Some of them, for example, one has a sort of coloured carpet. So they are actually sort of trying to distinguish themselves from each other and from the rest of the flock to an extent. So, you know, of course, there's massive competition between these big galleries and between the galleries and the auction houses. But in a funny way, it's also symbiotic, because one dealer said to me a bit earlier today, they said, well, did you see all those prices that were made last night at auction? You know, that has given people confidence. If people are prepared to go and lay out millions at auction for artworks, they'll come in here and spend money, perhaps not that much. But it does have a knock-on effect. So although in theory the galleries and the auctions are completely enemies, actually they do need each other.
That is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I think some of our listeners who would maybe, you know, be able to wander around and buy the odd thing, it's such an interesting and crazy different world. It's not like you went and spent, you know, £2 million in an auction last night, so you don't have any left over for freeze. It's actually like, do you know what? That felt really good. I'm going to go out and do the same thing again tomorrow and maybe the next day. I guess this is the sort of the world that we're talking about, isn't it?
Well, it's funny. Everyone always focuses on the top end of the market and the multi-million dollar prices. But actually, I think if you were able to, and you never would be able to get information about all the sales, I think you would find that actually the bulk of the sales are not at all at that level. They're probably in the £10,000 to £50,000 level, no more. And some are even lower. So I think it's good in a way, because it shows that people aren't necessarily that excluded, and you don't have to be a multimillionaire to be able to buy art.
I guess it's one of those things. We have talked about this ourselves before. There is such a kind of crazy long lens on the megabucks deals, isn't there? I suppose that's kind of where it makes good headlines in whichever paper you're writing.
Yes, I mean, journalists are always blamed for that, but unfortunately, you know, you can always say, well, it's because the public buys that story as well. So, you know, perhaps I'm kicking the argument out of touch there, but there's no doubt that the big prices make the headlines. And would you really be interested in reading a newspaper that had a headline story, unknown artists makes £2,000 at freeze? No, you're far more interested to know that a Christoph Buchel of A Sleeping Guard, who's a real alive seeking guard, could sell for €30,000, or I'm not quite sure what the price was.
Well, we've already had Freeze Masters described as a slam dunk over Freeze Contemporary today. But stay tuned. We're going to stay with Georgina Adam. We're going to bring in Ossian Ward from London's Listen Gallery. Stay tuned. We're coming to you live from the Freeze Art Fair in Regent's Park. It's 1817, and of course, it is Monocle 24.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's no man's sighted.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24. Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, hello there. It's 1818, and we're coming to you from Midori House, live from the Freeze Art Fair in Regent's Park. I'm Robert Bound, and we've got Sir Georgina Adam. She's our first guest. I mean, it's not like there isn't a pecking order here. I'd just like to point that out to our next guest.
Alphabetical.
Ossian Ward from London's Listen Gallery also joins us. Welcome to the show, Ossian.
Hello. I'm quite happy to be second best to Georgina.
Oh, no.
Did I just see a baton changing between your hands? Was that a baton? Yeah, I think so. Thank you. Thanks for coming on. And the Listen, we were just talking, I think, Georgina, before we went to a little break there, Georgina was talking about a gallery with a sort of technicolor carpet and how people are trying to differentiate themselves. It looks a little bit like the design on your sweatshirt, Ossian. Are the two related?
Or my iPad.
Or your iPad cover.
I'm totally merchandised up today. I'm brand man today. But yeah, I think it was the artist's decision to mess with our booth. It wasn't necessarily... We gave them sort of carte blanche within reason, and they ran with it. So Corey Archangel, who produces these gradients in Photoshop, he just picks the gradient tool and lets it do the rest. He's then carpeted our entire booth with this kind of rainbow gradient, which I'm sporting in various ways today also. And Ryan Gander, I'm wearing his pre-muddied trainers with special hand-painted Japanese mud Adidas collaboration. So there's lots of things, you know, people are wearing things and we're being told to do things. I was supposed to do a performance which involves me downloading a copy of Anchorman 3 and watching that on my iPad, but somehow I haven't had time. But there's been a lot
of... So that's what all these gallerists are doing when they're smoothly sitting in their booths looking at laptops.
We're watching
watching A-grade American comedy.
Will Ferrell movies, yeah. That's what I'd like to be doing now anyway.
Is it nice to be working for a gallery that's doing that? I mean, we were talking about how the design of the fair has changed a lot, and presumably the way that the tent's been messed around with and redesigned, and it looks, to my eyes, and I think Georgina's as well, looks like a much better space to work in, to look at art in, to sell art in. Is that what's been going on? I mean, it must be, you know, it's a little bit more balm for the artist's vanity, I guess, to be able to have a space like that to work in rather than the old badly lit jobs.
Well, it's the floor's not so bouncy, the walls are straighter. I mean, you know, there's a lot of improvements they've made, and it sounds silly to say that after 10 years of doing an art fair, you'd think that those were the basics, but it's very complicated. So they've raised the floor in order to make it as flat as they possibly can and as stable as they possibly can. I mean, it's still in a tent, it still has drawbacks, but I think, yeah, they've done a good job this year, and you have to keep refreshing yourself because the competition is so stiff, and they're obviously worried about, you know, adding Freeze Masters and Freeze New York, and, you know, everything has to keep moving apace, otherwise something falls behind or people get, you know, fair fatigue.
And I think fairgoers are more and more sophisticated as well. They expect to have really good food. Let me tell you, at the beginning, you did not got really, really good food in fairs. It was perfectly horrible. So that's improved as well.
Yeah. Yeah. We did ask you before we switch our microphones on, this is our voice test to get the right level from our microphones. We did ask Georgina what she had for her lunch. And did you go healthy, or did you go...
It was a little bit too healthy for me, I needed something really junky afterwards, but I've managed to find something.
She's been down that Gail's Artisan Bakery again, Ossian.
That's right.
and from that point of view, I wonder whether we kind of brought together the dream team again. The Georgina Adam and Ossian Ward show star in the current edition of Monocle. I just showed them their portraits in watercolour.
Lovely.
And I hope they're
very nice.
They're duly impressed.
Very nice.
But we talked on a Saturday a few weeks ago at Monocle's HQ about art versus aesthetics, and this was a Listen Gallery talk. And I wonder whether there's any chance of sort of moving that discussion forward here in the auspices of Frieze. It sounds like it can be. Whether the way the fair is set out, and there's lots of things, lots of kind of quite out there artworks, it seems. There's lots of curated stuff. This is not just, I think we called it over the couch art when we spoke a few weeks ago. Georgina, from a market point of view, do you see that? Do you see the fact that there's stranger stuff, there's stuff that you can't fit in a living room in here, to keep it to the contemporary fair for a minute? Do you see that as a sign of confidence in the market?
One of the problems with an art fair is you obviously can't really show the very, very big pieces. But I think that what a fair does is it perhaps introduces an artist, and then subsequently there might be a commission of something else. So I think that has an impact. Obviously, it's commercial. I mean, there's nothing wrong with selling art. Artists have to earn a living, so obviously things are for sale. But as I say, I'll come back to the live performances. I think that's very interesting because that is not obviously commercial, and that really adds to the atmosphere.
And that's an interesting thing. One of the performance pieces are a group of a dozen or so guys and girls with sort of red... pink turbans on, all joined together, like a sort of huge conga line. Mm. They're passing around the fair, they're sort of like tripping people up and sort of getting involved in sort of
Michael
different
Werner
things.
Gallery and bought it, and it's a reproduction of a 1968 work.
Oh,
I think it was. Yes, yes.
And it's quite nice, and that's sort of proper intervention in an art fair, and it's quite funny to see some well-knownish collectors and art dealers looking a bit harumphy about that.
Well, I was joking about me sitting on the booth watching Anchorman on my iPad, but that's been designed by Corey Archangel.
I was just trying to buy that.
Oh, well, you can, but we don't know how much it costs yet because I haven't done it. But no, the idea is that it does disrupt or intervene in the normal running of the fair. You know, it's designed to stop me working for 2 hours. But the live programme does that in many different ways. I mean, I've just been up to the Silber Cooper, which is part of the live stream, where someone is writing art criticism on the walls, and that's been performed in interpretive dance, but in this kind of, it's called glide, which is one step on from trap, and you know, it's this kind of cool dancing. But so there are ways in which people are really trying to mess with the fair. I think even more so in the case of, I just heard that Kim Gordon was on earlier with one of her kind of screechy guitar pieces where she kind of caresses the guitar, loud feedback, and sort of rubs it up against a post. And then some woman from the neighbouring booth came storming in, said, "I paid lots of money for this booth, you must stop this right now." And that was the end of it. So, you know, I think the live performance is there to get in amongst what's happening on the booths and sort of break that up a bit. So it's a good addition. And I think, you know, the live part is good. I think it just changes every year, and that's what keeps Frieze fresh, because with all the other art fairs, there's always got to be a point of difference, and Frieze still tries to be that sort of more one step ahead, cutting edge, keep things new, keep things fresh. People have made an effort with their booths, carpeting, the wallpapering, the colours, you know, the interactivity. And I mean, we do it because it's our local fair. We don't feel like we need to prove to anyone who we are, or we're not in the Middle East, we're not sort of introducing our artists to an alien audience. They should know what we do, and we want to surprise them.
I always think of back, it was the project a few years ago, but when Mike Nelson disrupted by having this extraordinary I don't know what to call it, installation, I suppose, that was actually between booths. And when you think that that led on to him going to the Venice Biennale, and that was a non-commercial project.
It's a strange thing. These things can work. It's not just Frieze putting some grit in its own oyster.
No. It actually, something came out of that.
And is that the thing? It sounds, before we go to the bottom of the air, actually, we have to kiss goodbye to you both, actually. We should talk about this. Whether Frieze this year... We'll talk about the Contemporary Fair first, but whether it's we can only really talk about the Contemporary Fair. We can't really talk about Masters in terms of discovering something new. Well, maybe we can, but whether the way it's set out, whether that some of the booth presentations are things where you can really find something new, you can learn about a new artist, and be kind of blinded by a bit of science. Austin,
I don't know about the science. I've definitely been blinded by newness, and which is good. You know, you see things that really are new and experimental, and sometimes a bit jokey. There's some great Mark Flood paintings of these Spider-Man memes, you know, taken from a Spider-Man cartoon but written by other people and then turned into a painting. So there's lots of stuff that feels like it's raw and energetic and different, and that's what you want. And equally, you can find beautiful little Derek Jarman paintings from 1973. So, you know, people will always keep it sort of safe because it's an art fair. You're not going to get people just completely going to town on it. But solo booths, single presentations, you'll find that the artists will gain more traction from that than they will from being in a mixed hang of a bit of everything.
And I have to put in a word, because I think actually Frieze Masters does plug into this, because you need to go to Frieze Masters because you see where a lot of this has come from.
Right. Yeah, you see
that. You know, get some depth to what you're looking at.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing. In which order would you look at these two art fairs? One's just, we should say, if not spitting distance, then a stone's throw.
It all depends on the traffic.
Or if you're walking in my pre-muddied trainers straight through the park, it's about 15 minutes.
Yes.
Have you been not let in anywhere, by the way?
I mean, I could stain their carpets, but I mean, I do look a bit like I've come straight out of a rave or something. I'm not going to turn up to Frieze Masters looking like this, but I think they've staggered it in a strange way in that, you know, they both open on the same day, one earlier than the other, so we'll see how it pans out. Unfortunately, it's not frees are not open on Sunday for the public, which I think is a bit...
It is a pity, yeah. Yes. I mean, yes, ideally, I think probably you would start with Masters because that would be a chronological, historical way of doing it. But obviously, for reasons that are best known to the organisers, that's the way they've done it.
We start with a Norman gargoyle that fell off a church in France, and we end with fabulous. Ossian Ward's Ryan Gander trainers.
Ryan Gander trainers. Or the Christophe Buckel.
Yeah.
Sleeping.
To spot the difference.
Yes,
narcoleptic he is as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to thank you both. And I should also point people in direction of the current issue of Monocle, where also you're talking about the kickoff for your books. You're talking about Georgina Adams' Big Bucks, which is out now, and Ossian Ward's Ways of Looking, which is also out now. Check out that in the magazine. It is exactly 6:30 here. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair in Regent's Park in London. We're going to go back to the studio for the international news headlines.
Rob, thanks very much. The World Health Organization says the number of Ebola cases in a vast outbreak in West Africa will reach over 9,000 this week, and the epidemic is still expanding geographically in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia. The death toll so far in the outbreak has now reached 4,447. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who has visited Gaza for the first time since the war, has called the situation beyond description, and he urged a speedy reconstruction effort. An estimated 180,000 people have been forced to flee the Iraqi city of Hit after it was captured by ISIS and affiliated forces, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has said at a news briefing on Tuesday. And Catalonia has dropped plans to hold a referendum on independence from Spain next month, but will instead hold what it calls a consultation of citizens, the region's president has said today. And for the moment, that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
All right, it's 18:31 here in London, and the hubbub around me you can hear is not the usual dead space conditions of Studio One. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair, and it's VIP day here in Regent's Park. There's been plenty going on here at Frieze, but we thought we'd take a look at what some of the galleries are doing outside of these finely curated walls. Over the weekend, Monocle's Holly Fisher headed down to Clapham in South London, where Studio Voltaire lives. The gallery's latest commissions are from photographer Anne Collier and once Turner-nominated performance artist Marvin Gaye Chetwynd. Here's what Holly did.
Studio Voltaire, located in South London, is a not-for-profit outfit helping budding artists at key points in their career. They boast educational programmes, affordable workspace and a gallery. The company's most recent commissions are Anne Collier's Women with Cameras and Marvin Gaye Chetwynd's Hamito's Children 2. I speak to Studio Voltaire's director Joe Scotland at the preview of these two very different works.
With both artists, it's actually their first solo shows in an institutional space within London. Anne Collier is an artist based in New York, and she is predominantly known as a photographer, and the work we're showing is quite unusual. It's a slide piece, and it relates to an ongoing series she has called Woman with a Camera.
Anne Collier's exhibition takes place in a small square white room with only a projector in it. A slideshow of photographs, posters and magazine covers of women holding cameras clicks by.
It's quite an unusual piece in that it's a slide projection. I think most people will know her still photography work. So it's actually the only second time she's done this slide installation. Anne's very interested in kind of like modes of representation. Within her photographic work, she kind of, it could be described as still lifes as such, but it's also about kind of appropriation of imagery. So in quite a cold scientific way, she kind of documents existing objects, so they might be film posters or magazine covers.
When you have two different exhibitions running alongside each other, how do you curate that? Do you think which two exhibitions will complement each other, or are they very separate?
They're actually very separate. Like, in some ways you can get more two different shows. Marvin's is so like immersive, over the top, and there's like a real, like, her aesthetic is really lo-fi, whereas Anne is very kind of slick and purposely cold. With both shows, they kind of deal with ideas around representation in some ways, and actually particularly around kind of female sexuality.
We head to a much larger room in the gallery to see Hamito's Children 2. and Over the Top sums it up pretty well. The work is a performance piece spliced together with a humorous, bizarre but quite delightful film, which is shown in a dark room with a pink hue. There are enormous photocopies of cats, clowns and bikers stuck to the walls, and a giant ball puppet lies dormant to one side.
It's her biggest film commission she's been doing to date, and we've been working with her over the last 18 months producing a new film, and it's filmed with various kind of locations like Australia, Malta, Glasgow and various other places, and including footage from a performance which took place in the gallery a month earlier. She's been developing this project called Hamita's Children, where she's trying to get away from straightforward documentation of performance works. So within the film, she kind of uses the performance as a backdrop for a wider narrative. So with the commission we did here at Studio Voltaire, Listen Up, which was last month, she's utilized the live action and edited it within the film itself. So on the night, there was a couple of dance routines, and the most kind of spectacular thing, we had some bull jumping. So we actually had her suspended from the ceiling and jumping over a life-size puppet bull.
And bull chargings and things like that, frequent events here at Studio Voltaire.
Well, we've had dancing dogs before, but this is the first time we've had a charging bull.
But that's not even the wackiest part of the performance. I asked Joe about the film's narrative and his starring role.
Someone is here in the class who has not paid membership.
So I play Joan Shipman. She's a female detective who investigates sex crimes. So in the latest episode, I'm investigating catting, which is very similar to dogging, but it takes place on boats.
This is something that needs to be addressed.
Well, in the film, actually, someone's being blackmailed because they've been there's pictures taken of them engaging in catting. I'm not sure if it really exists, but I think it might do after this. 2015, it's going to be a new trend, yeah.
While you heard it here first, Hamita's Children 2 and Women with Cameras are on at Studio Voltaire until the 14th of December. For Monocle in London, I'm Holly Fisher.
Well, that was pretty weird. Thank you very much, Holly. Now, back at Frieze this year, there's a new element called Frieze Live. That's the opportunity for immersive and interactive works from around the fair. And our very own Guy Lutz headed out into one of the booths far away in one of the far corners of this new tent to go and eat some radioactive soup.
My name is A. Arakawa. I'm one of artists from United Brothers. I was born in Iwaki City, Fukushima, Japan, in famous for nuclear disaster. And here at the Frieze, we have a project called Does This Soup Taste Ambivalent? With question mark. Every day, 1 p.m., we serve a soup with the ingredient from Iwaki, Fukushima. Actually, my mother flew from Japan, and this is her first time to be in the UK, and she's cooking the soup. We did a checkup about the cesium level of the vegetable, and vegetable is not radioactive for the cesium, and so we think it's safe. However, you know, because of a media experience of Fukushima, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about if the vegetable from Fukushima is safe or not.
How has the response been to this experiment? Have many people declined to taste the soup?
Actually, the audience at the Frieze, they are very, almost like a reckless. So they don't need the information I provided on the wall. So they, as soon as they found the soup for free, they just eat them without knowing what it is.
And do you tell them after what it is?
Well, before I tell something, they sometimes go away. So I think it's better to spend some time and think about what you're actually eating.
Of course, and then in that way, you're part of that artwork yourself with your thoughts.
Exactly. That kind of a choice is the part of artwork that we wanted to present through this soup project.
Perfect. So maybe I can try a little bit and see if it tastes ambivalent for myself. Sorry, if you could tell me a little bit of what vegetables did you use for the soup?
So the soup has a radish, daikon radish, and shiitake mushroom from Fukushima.
So I guess this is my time to reflect now on what I'm about to do. To take some soup made from vegetables from Fukushima. Let's do it. Very nice. Thank you to your mom.
So it's a very normal soup that we are eating at home. So we'll see the range of reactions. I'm sure, you know, certain people are very afraid of anything from Japan. And, you know, some people are more informed about the scientific research. And, you know, I think we just have to sort of figure out the information ourselves.
And that was Guy Lutz sampling some radioactive soup with Ai Arakawa of the United Brothers, and that's part of the Green Tea Gallery here at Frieze London. I particularly liked Ai Arakawa's rendering of shiitake mushrooms. Wondering if he can swear on Monocle 24. I think he's proved that you can. It's 18:41 here in London. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair here in Regent's Park in London. We'll be taking a break, and then I'll be chatting to the artist Ryan Gander. Stay very much tuned.
Once a fading relic of the Cold War, Bikini Berlin is a newly redesigned complex mixing retail, culture, and creative thinking. Monocle Films explores how intelligent ideas are helping to redefine the shopping mall model.
We are a part of a destination of the City West, and so we want to create something special in this urban destination. I think nowadays you get everything at every time and every place. So you have to be something special that customers will come.
Bare Essentials, premiering in the Films menu at monocle.com.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luskin every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
It's Midori House, Jim, but not as you know it. Welcome back to the show with me, Robert Bound. We're live at the Frieze Art Fair in London's Regent Park this evening. The party is in full swing in the main halls behind us. You might be able to hear that. You might be able to hear the clink of the champagne flute. You might be able to hear the airiest of air kisses. Earlier on today, though, I got my hands dirty and spoke to an actual artist. I headed over to the Listen Gallery's booth to meet British artist Ryan Gander. He began by telling me about the incredibly bright carpet beneath us.
It's a bit of a seamless mishmash, isn't it, of different artists. It's kind of weird that the aesthetics of each work are so mixed that you could mistake one artist making one work for another. The carpet's Corey Archangel, who's in New York, and he's a friend. He works with the gallery, and it's a gradient. So I think, to be honest, they're quite easy to make. You do it on Photoshop and send it off to the factory, and then...
He's not here to defend himself. You realise that?
No, exactly. That's why That's why I'm saying it.
I wanted to ask you about the pieces you've got here. You've got some, and people maybe know your practice. You work with lots of unusual materials, lots of very ordinary seeing materials sometimes, and not otherwise. But maybe you could tell us what you're showing here this afternoon as well.
I'm showing a new painting. I don't paint, so this is me attempting to, or pretend to be a painter, toy with the idea of painting. So it's almost like conceptual art that uses the tool of painting, but it's not really painting, which I guess most painters would be a little bit upset by. And then there's also some new sculptures that are made of pebble-concrete on walnut plinths. It's kind of weird because I only saw them yesterday when they were unpacking them, because they were at the fabricators and I'd been down to check them, but I hadn't really seen them in their entirety.
And they're making, these are being shot a lot. There's a lot of TV crews around today, and these are the apples of people's eyes.
I'm quite surprised because when they opened the crate, I actually thought they looked like big mind poos. Do you know what I mean? They look like they're kind of messy and dirty. And then I had a really great SMS exchange with one of the gallerists here about them being ugly, and that I was a little bit, I came out in a hot sweat when I saw them with fear that they were too ugly. But then it slowly dawned on me that there's so much good-looking stuff here. It's nice to have a bit of ugliness that means something.
Yeah, but they look like they've been something that might have been pulled out of the ground 2,000 years ago. They've got a bit of history about them as much as something that's very contemporary. But concrete's a funny material, isn't it? Because it's sort of old but new. It's not like it came out yesterday. There's something kind of gnarly and ancient about it, right?
They're a bit South Bank centre. There's a little bit of brutalism about them, I think. They're weird shapes and you can't really work out what they are. They look a bit like dolphins, or they look a bit like a butterfly or something. But when I take my daughter to school, we have to sit in the car park in the car, and I have this bag of little foam sticky back shapes from a craft kit, and she makes little things. And actually my daughter made these.
She's inspired the shapes of them.
Yeah, I took the models that she made to the fabricator, and we upscaled them and produced them in this concrete.
Is she proud of the final result? Have you texted her a picture of how they ended up?
She saw them and she said to my wife, "Daddy's copying me."
That's what every artist wants to hear, right?
The prophet next, I'm sure.
My eyes are rested again on this painting. You've been pretty happy with the borders, with the canvas. Luckily, it doesn't have a frame. If I wanted to buy that, what would I be buying? Would I have to buy the whole wall of the booth?
You buy the canvas with the paint on it, and then the bits that are all over the wall, they're vinyl stickers. So you'd get a set of vinyl stickers with it, which can be reproduced when you move the painting. But essentially, I like the idea that, you know, art quite literally is all over the wall. It's a bit of a mess. It's thrown at the walls. It's sort of spat out.
I like the kind of vibe of it as well, that it's got a sort of like 80s skiing.
The sort of backstory is, it's quite similar to the sculptures that were inspired by my daughter's sculptures. It's kind of like this work already exists in the world. So the graphics and the logos that you see on the painting, they're all from caravans. So you know, you get this horrible visual language on caravans and mobile homes that doesn't actually equate to anything. It doesn't mean freedom, and it doesn't mean the forest or alpine or speed or endeavour or anything, really. It's like speaking Gaga in visual language. It's just stuttering. So I took all those stutterings and made a recomposition, but it looks like art.
They're always called something like a Cavalier GL240. I mean, that is probably a Vauxhall car from the 80s as well, but there is something.
Swift is a good one, or Endeavour is always another one.
Eurocabin.
Oh, Eurocabin, very alpine.
You haven't had a chance to have a proper look around yet, but are there hearing things through the grapevine? Are there a couple of things that you want to have a look at? I guess there's a lot of performance bits and bobs here this year as well. Does that feel strange at a fair like this, or is it kind of a bit of a welcome break?
But you know, the whole art world's changing so much at the moment. It feels like it's not really settled on what it will become, but it's like some really quasi monster that doesn't know who it is, and then just this whole post-internet aesthetic that's kind of a bit tiring. It seems to have run its course already. It only lasted for about 6 months. Everyone's sick of it. There'll be something else next, I don't know.
Concrete mind poos, I'd have said. That's what my money's on.
Mind poos is the way forwards, I'm sure.
And that was artist Ryan Gander chatting to me a little earlier on today at the Listen Gallery booth. Up next, Artists are sometimes rare beasts at art fairs. Lots of art, not a lot of artists sometimes. But we've got Eric Fischel with us to take you to the top of the hour. Eric Fischel is coming up next. It's 18:49 and you're tuned into Midori House. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair in London's Regent's Park. I was reading the script and it said we're reaching the end of the show in Regent's Park. We are fast approaching the end of the programme, but before we go, we're going to be joined by artist Eric Fischel, whose paintings, which are currently being exhibited at the Victoria Miro Gallery, are of people looking at art at contemporary art fairs. How appropriate. And here he is, the man himself. Eric, welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
And as I said, to introduce you, it's rare. Artists, strangely, a rare beast at art fairs. There's a lot of work on display, but not a lot of workers. It's an interesting idea, riffing off the idea of people looking at paintings,
or not looking at,
or not looking at paintings precisely. Yeah. When did you hit on this as a nice idea for a new body of work? People not looking at paintings, but standing pretty near to them.
Right. I started the body of work about 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago. And at the time I started, it was just one painting, but one led to another, to another.
It turned into
a lot of fun, anyway.
And did anyone recognize themselves in these portraits? How fictional are your buyers, your browsers?
Everybody in the painting is somebody. I don't know who almost anybody is. I think I know two people in the work. So far, one girl has seen herself in it and was thrilled by that.
She saw herself and liked it.
Yeah, there's a few people that have seen other people in it and are anxious to hear what they have to say about it.
And this is, I guess, we can hear the sort of hubbub of the art fair around us. And it sounds nice in my headphones, at least.
Yeah.
And that's part and parcel. It's obviously a social occasion. How good is it? You've come in here with your camera. I think you've just started taking photographs, presumably of works or people looking near or around works. How good is it as an artist to discover new stuff here, to find things you like?
Well, I started out in a deeply kind of cynical approach where I was really going to try to stick it to the art world because I'm appalled by the direction the art world's gone in. But as I began to photograph the sort of teeming life in this place, I changed a bit. I got excited about it's the human parade. And
yeah.
It's very amusing and exciting and, you know, yeah.
And it's an interesting thing, I mean, to render these. Does it start off with a photograph, these things?
Paintings all start as photographs that I put into Photoshop, cut and paste and recreate scenes. So none of the paintings are directly connected to one photograph. They're all many photographs.
And the works that you can see in the paintings themselves, are paintings of paintings?
They're paintings of paintings, or paintings of photographs, or sculptures. They're all other people's art. It's real. Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. There is a sort of idea of pop eating itself here.
Slightly. Yeah.
It's a nice thing. But in terms personally, is it a good place to come and discover stuff? Whether it's Frieze this week, whether it's Art Basel.
Discover, you mean discover what?
To find something that you never knew you liked in terms of an artist, perhaps.
I certainly, in terms of looking at other art, I find it very hard to take it in. You know, it's more of a, the whole thing's a spectacle, so it's hard to really slow down to a pace that you can absorb the complexity of an expression or something. So to me, they sort of form backdrops. When I get back into my studio and I start to put them in paintings, I spend more time with them. It becomes more interesting.
And there's an idea, I mean, the body language of your subjects is obviously kind of part and parcel as well.
Mm-hmm.
People, leaning over each other's shoulders to sort of meet and greet someone else rather than maybe scrutinizing whatever sculpture or painting it might be on the wall. Is this something as well? I mean, do you have to mess around with people's postures and the way people are, or is that all there on the photograph that you take?
Usually the people that I put in the paintings have a body language that evokes a lot of thoughts and feelings in me, and so I go with that. Yeah, I don't put somebody else's arm on somebody else's body, but yeah, they're all very expressive, very particular.
And what are the thoughts and emotions?
You get a sense that there's an agenda,
right?
And it's kind of fun to figure out what that agenda is. So,
and you're obviously here at the fair today. Victoria Miro is showing your work. Mm-hmm. I think here and at the gallery, right?
Yes.
And is that sort of, well, let's go exceptionally meta here, Eric, and talk about what's it like when you're looking at people looking at paintings of people looking at paintings.
What is the
or do you presumably that's the next level of your work is to look at these is to be on Victoria Miro's stand on an afternoon like this afternoon and see people not looking at your paintings but trying to meet this collector or journalist or this guy or that guy.
Sell this work.
Or checking out that.
What exactly is the currency of exchange here? Is it just a buy and sell thing? Is it an impress thing? Is it, a kind of flirtation? Is it, all those things are happening simultaneously. So it's a complicated social milieu and it's rarefied, it's elite, it has a lot of stuff going on in it. Some of it feels like American movies from the 30s and, sort of Philadelphia Story or Palm Beach Story or those kind of things.
There is a Gatsby element to some of these.
I think that's present as well, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a tragedy involved. Ultimately, a tragic.
There's fast cars, sharp suits, and tears at the end.
Not giving you what you want.
Tears before bedtime, right?
Or what you need, I should say. Yeah.
And has anyone complained? Has anyone spotted themselves and complained? Does anyone not want to be? Do people have to sign a release form to be in an Eric Fischel painting?
Don't tell anybody, but I haven't gotten a release form from anybody, so hopefully it won't come back in my face. But
okay, well, we won't.
Nobody's going to know, right? I'm not talking publicly.
It's fine. This is just between the two of us. Do not worry about it.
I do portraits of people, they are usually shocked at how I portray them, and I. Recently, I either make them look too old or too fat or, too tired or something. And recently I did a self-portrait and a friend of mine who I painted many times said, well, I'm glad to see you treat yourself as badly as you treat everybody else. So
that's the way, right?
Yeah,
the artist's eye never lies.
Yeah, exactly.
Even when you're examining yourself.
Yourself, yeah.
And why do you think... artists find it an art fair a tough place to be? You've made a nice niche, at least with your current body of work, to not lampoon it, but to have a critical eye on this. Yes.
It's the only way
cultural
you can tolerate
and financial exchange.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think lots of artists find it a funny old place to be?
Well, they often talk about
that's the alarm going off because someone has noticed that they're in one of your paintings. And do you know what? They don't like it, Eric.
I got it. They're coming for me.
Yeah,
but people talk a lot about the it's like cows going to a slaughterhouse. It's something where the reason you make the thing is not the reason it's being merchandised, and so it's always disappointing or deflating or something like that.
Well, we hope those aren't disappointing and deflating. We hope that those aren't the last two words we're going to hear from Free's Contemporary 2014. But we've run out of time. Eric Fischel, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Point people in the direction of the Victoria Miro Gallery and the booth indeed here at Free's. That is indeed all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you to all my guests here at Free's London. Today's show was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Gaia Lutz. Our studio manager here was Bill Luty, and back in the studio at Midori House was Joel Church and Tom Edwards. made a fine barman. Next, after the news headlines, is our design show, Section D. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, where we'll be broadcasting live from Freeze Masters. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds, thank you very much for tuning in.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.